You're listening to Greater LA, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Good evening. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Today, there was a sea of blue and gold out in the streets celebrating a big event in LA sports history.
The Rams were built to win the Super Bowl, and they have sealed the deal.
And fans all across the Southland came out for a big victory parade that started earlier today at the Shrine Auditorium and then went along, meandered down Figueroa Street toward the Coliseum, of course, where the Rams used to play years ago, and it culminated in a big lunchtime rally today. It was the first parade in LA for a sports championship since before the pandemic. And the day, of course, it comes that outdoor mask mandates have been dropped in L.A. County as well. Well, KCRW's Kaylee Wells talked to fans all along the parade route. She joins me now from where all the excitement was earlier today. Hey, Kaylee.
Hey, Steve.
So what happened today? Where did things sort of start, and how did they culminate, and where are you right now?
Well, they started out at the Shrine Auditorium. That was at late this morning. There were buses with team members, with cheerleaders, and, of course, the very important trophy that they secured for L.A. on Sunday. So they paraded down Figueroa to the Coliseum, which, as you said, that's where the Rams played until 2019 when the SoFi Stadium was finished for them. And then we had a rally that happened at noon where we had team members speaking, officials speaking, cheers with the crowd, and just about no room to breathe. So now I'm just sitting on Figueroa and sort of basking in the glory and looking at the pieces of paper, that the confetti that, oh my gosh, it's going to take days to clean up.
Did you see a lot of people maskless today?
I did. The metro ride to the parade was pretty good. Everyone stayed masked. But, you know, as you said, the outdoor mask mandate went away today. So nobody really had to. And you had some people who probably did it for their own protection.
Yeah.
But I would say that was the minority of people.
Yeah. The Rams, as you mentioned, moved back to L.A. in 2016. So some of the fan base is fairly new. Or maybe there are some holdovers from when the team was here before 1995. Are you hearing, or did you hear earlier today, you know, folks that they've recently made the switch to support the Rams? Or were there some, you know, longtime Rams fans at today's festivities?
We definitely had both, but I would say the majority of people were the ones who jumped on the bandwagon when they came in 2016. So they left in 1995, and I mean, if you're in your 20s, you wouldn't have even remembered that you should have been a Rams fan back then. So Alejandro Massa Lopez, he was one of those people. He was out here very early leading cheers well before the team arrived. He's a newer fan that started cheering for the Rams in 2016, but he is no less enthusiastic, even though he is one of the more recent fans.
For 5 years now, since my city got his new team, we needed him. They brought back the best surf on turf. The mob squad is mobbing.
I know. And then there's also people who remember going to games in LA when they were little. And occasionally you get people who even stayed loyal the entire time they were gone. So Michael Evans is one of those. He's a lifelong fan who remembers being a kid back when Dickerson was playing through their stint in St. Louis, which I think lasted 21 years. So, you know, he had to wait a long time before they came back to LA. And now he's here celebrating the Lakers and the Dodgers, too, who, as you remember, won in 2020, but they didn't get a parade until today.
The Lakers is good and the Dodgers. I hope they do it a little celebration for all of them. That'd be great.
Yeah.
So they didn't get a chance to have one.
Yeah, you mentioned 2020. You know, during that year, there wasn't a whole lot of celebrating going on, certainly outside. Everybody was trying to stay away from one another. Obviously, the main team were celebrating and have been celebrating today are the Rams, but the Lakers and Dodgers also both won those championships a few years back. Are you seeing some gold and purple and Dodger blue as well among that other sea of blue and gold?
Not a lot, but there are definitely some. I would say there were maybe 95% of the jerseys I saw were the blue and gold for the Rams and their performance on Sunday. But, You know, LeBron James, of the Lakers, of course, he tweeted, hey, let's celebrate the Lakers and Dodgers wins in 2020 as well, since the pandemic didn't let them celebrate. So we did have some people who came out in their purple and gold or their Dodger blue. Roscoe Gray was actually one of them. He's from Cleveland originally, so anyone who knows LeBron James, they would remember that he used to play for the Cleveland Cavs before he came here. So you wouldn't be surprised to know that he's been a fan ever since then, and that's why he wore his Lakers stuff today.
Unfortunately, I am a 49ers fan, and I'm a Lakers fan, but I'm in L.A., so I'm going to celebrate L.A.'s victory.
And by the way, let's focus on that Lakers fandom. We don't really need to bring up the whole 49ers thing. That's not very popular today.
Yeah, they didn't make it to the Super Bowl this year, did they?
No, you know what? You're right. They did not make it to the Super Bowl this year. I also spoke to someone, Amber V. She brought her toddler out here today, and she was actually in a Dodgers hat. So, of course, I had to go up to her and ask who she was here to support.
I've actually been a Rams fan for a while. I used to go to games with my dad when they were out here. So it was a while. I don't really buy a lot of gear. I ended up going to the Dodgers game when they were in the playoffs. So that was a lot of fun. And I just think it's been a really good time for LA right now. So it's a great time to come celebrate.
Yes, a lot of celebration today, earlier at Exposition Park near the Coliseum. I know the last victory parade in L.A. was for the Kings, the hockey team in 2014, when they won it all in the NHL, the Stanley Cup. So a big day for L.A. KCRW's Kaylee Wells reporting for us from Exposition Park. Kaylee, thanks.
Of course. Thanks, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, winning the Super Bowl is one of the biggest things there is in pro sports in America. Football is by far the most popular sport. You know, the last time Gallup polled people on their favorite sport to watch, football was more than three times as popular as the number two, basketball. But you wouldn't know it from what the kids are playing these days. In youth sports, basketball is the leader. Participation in tackle football trails, soccer, baseball, and even swimming. Could the Rams' big win at SoFi last weekend make a difference? Might a few more young athletes decide to give football a try? Well, one person who would no doubt support that decision is Lorenzo Hernandez. He's the head football coach at Garfield High School in East L.A. Coach, welcome to you.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for having me on. Appreciate being on.
You bet. Also here is Tim Mosicki. He's head athletic trainer over at Loyola High School here in L.A. Tim, welcome to you.
Thank you. Hi.
Lorenzo, I'm going to start with you. I have read that the numbers are inching up a little bit again, but what are your thoughts on a lot of these schools having trouble recruiting enough kids to fill football teams these days?
Well, definitely. I think that is a very true statement. I think back in the day, pre-COVID-19 pandemic, the numbers are starting to dwindle. And, you know, that was kind of, you know, the big hammer that dropped on us as soon as the pandemic hit. It was very, very difficult to establish numbers. And I think now we're starting to see some kids get excited a little bit about it. Definitely the Rams being in Los Angeles really, really helped that cause. We definitely saw our numbers increase at the end of December here prior to the winter break.
Tim, what about you? What are you seeing out there across LA in terms of participation of young athletes and tackle football programs?
I agree with Coach Lorenzo. I think the numbers are starting to tick back up. Before COVID hit, you know, concussions and injuries were a big thing, and football took a big majority of the hit for those, and numbers dropped. But COVID, it's really hard. Especially, you know, these last couple of years of, you know, kids wanting to come and play contact sports at all. So I think this next year, I think we're going to see numbers climb back up. I don't know how high they're going to climb back up. A lot of schools are down to two teams now. we're kind of blessed here at Loyola that we still can field three teams, but it is getting hard to field, you know, two teams.
I mean, what do you say, though, about the pushback, right? I mean, COVID notwithstanding, what's happened, you know, the past couple of years, and we don't want to get that close to anybody these days, but, I mean, do you think the fall off has had to do with a lot of parents pushing back and saying, this is really dangerous? There's a lot of blows to the head. There's, you know, the fact that you've got CTE and concussions and brain damage caused by the repeated hits to the head, and parents being really worried about that and concerned.
I think that's a valid statement, but, you know, rules and practices have come a long way recently, and football to me has gotten a lot safer. I've seen a dramatic decrease with head injuries as far as just, you know, practice times, contact practice times, coaches, you know, really coaching good technique and good form. So, I mean, things are headed in that direction to where I think football can become very safe. You're never going to get rid of all the injuries. It's a contact sport, just like rugby and soccer and all the other sports and lacrosse. But I think football's a great sport. Both my sons played football. One played 2 years and the other one played 4 years. It's just, you know, when this whole concussion thing started, you know, 10 whatever years ago, it really made people almost panic too far to, oh my God, you know, every hit he could end up in the hospital, and that's not the case.
What Tim stated is very important. You know, the safety of the game has truly evolved over the last 10 to 15 years in regards to proper technique and progression and things of that nature. Those are things that a lot of us, you know, sitting in meetings and bringing in experts and things of that nature, we were able to identify. And I think the biggest key and the biggest takeaway from me was, if we don't know how to protect this game, we're going to lose it as a whole. And that really hit home to me, because I think just teaching the best that you can do, things are always going to happen. Accidents are always going to happen. They're not preventable by no means. But if you can mitigate most of it, I think you do a great job. I, like Tim, have a son that's a ninth grader here at Garfield, and, you know, he played youth football and all that stuff. So, of course, I'm like a hawk, assuring that things are being done correctly. I signed up to be the player safety coach with that in mind in our youth football program, just because I don't want to lose the game.
What about the younger players, Lorenzo, coming up through Pop Warner and through middle school? There was a bill in the state legislature in Sacramento that did not pass, but it would have stopped kids from playing any tackle football before high school. What do you think is the right age for kids to start playing tackle football?
You know, I don't know if there's a right age. All I know is that if you can teach the fundamental of football and work your way up in a progressive manner, I think you'll be okay. However, you know, I think every parent might gauge their kid at a particular time. Like, for example, I'll use my son as an example. He did not want to play his last year of youth football at the time because of the particular rules of weight and height and all this. The kid's a big boy. And he literally had to nearly starve himself to be able to make weight. I think that was a problem. However, no one wanted to address it up until the point when the state decided they wanted to take hold of this, and that just changed things dramatically. Now, in that same league of which my son played in, now there is no weight limit for that particular position or those particular individuals. They got to wear an identifier, an X on their helmet that states, hey, this student can only play at this position. You know, so they made adjustments. So I just think there is no particular right age. I just think it's about doing certain things to adjust to make it as safe as we possibly can.
Tim Mosicki, what do you think of the idea, you know, of kids waiting until they're into high school, or at least to age 14? Is that an appropriate age? Should there be an age?
If you would have asked me that question several years ago, I would have said yes. But now, like Coach Lorenzo was saying, with all the improvements and the safeties that have been put into play, education with the Pop Warner coaches about proper technique, proper drills, all that, it's now, I think, okay. And it's kind of up to the parents and the child. And if they are willing to play and they do it right and they have all the safeties in place, they have people there at games that when someone gets hurt, someone that knows what to do is there to take care of them, 10, 15 years ago, I'm not too sure how much of that was really happening. But it's tremendously improved. And I really have no problem with kids playing youth Pop Warner now.
I understand you have a couple of Loyola alumni playing for the Rams in the Super Bowl last weekend, right? I mean, that's got to be a thrill for the program.
Oh, yeah. We had David Long, who played on defense, and Coleman Shelton, who's the offensive lineman. He's the backup center and backup guard. So we're all rooting for them, too.
And you know, I asked Coach Lorenzo this. I mean, how much are young athletes motivated by, you know, the prospect of a college scholarship and then maybe even a pro career beyond that, getting drafted into the NFL or one of the other pro leagues?
Yeah, well, you know, I agree with Tim. You know, with Long, the cornerback, is a phenomenal athlete. I think those are the kids that our student athletes can see and go, wow, this kid was able to make it out, you know, out of a local school in Los Angeles. And I think our kids, again, something tangible, something they can see in reality and go, hey, I also can dream big and be able to be on a stage, you know, like the Super Bowl, and be a part of an NFL team making their way through college. And I think that's what our biggest word nowadays from most of our athletes is, I want an offer. That's the meaning that they want a scholarship offer.
Tim, what do you think?
I agree with Coach. I think, you know, the more that kids can relate to someone from their own neighborhood, their own city, the more excitement it brings. So, you know, having the Rams back in town and the Chargers, but the Rams, you know, obviously winning the Super Bowl, you know, and, you know, having our kids can immediately relate to David and Coleman because they were students here. They played football here. So I think it does help a lot.
Lorenzo, you have a special connection with the Rams as well. I mean, last year, the team named you Coach of the Year. Congratulations on that. And I understand there was a cash prize to go with it, too. What have you been spending the money on?
Well, thank you. And yes, you know, I was extremely honored and humbled, you know, by the Rams. Again, it's a professional organization, and, you know, it just kind of validates not my job by no means, but just the job that my staff does and our student athletes, as well as our community and our district as a whole. But, you know, one of the major things that we spent most of our monies on because of COVID, because of the lack of being out there and fundraising, it couldn't come at a better time for us, to be honest with you. It just gave us an opportunity to provide pregame meals for our athletes. Our athletes, you know, you send them off to go eat, they'll come back with a bag of chips and a Coke, you know, so it's always important to keep the nutrition aspect of it in mind prior to them playing a high level game. So most of it was due to that. You know, we have about 100 kids or more, and then we $8 a meal, it's almost $800 a week for 10 weeks. That's about $8,000. So that helped tremendously.
Coach Lorenzo, football also can help give young players the support of being part of a team, right? I mean, that bonding experience, that, you know, coming together with a goal. I mean, it can also bring the community together, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like we tell them, you build lasting memories, and that's one thing that you build on. And myself, as that as an example, I was able to make unbelievable friendships that, you know, now our families co-mingle and do things of that nature. But I mean, it's just an unbelievable experience for any athlete, because I tell them, you know, when they shed tears at, you know, the end of the season or what else, is just the amount of time that you spend as a group. And I don't think a lot of people take that to heart, but when you're able to see through that and say, wow, these guys spent countless amount of time in the weight room, you know, academically, at lunchtime, then preparing for football games, and at football games, they spend so much time together that when they say family, that's what it really truly means. You develop so many skills, not only fundamentally, socially, discipline factors, that we hope we can develop young men and women moving forward into our social environment with the proper attitude.
Coach Lorenzo Hernandez, who heads up the football program at Garfield High in East L.A. Tim Mosicki, head athletic trainer over at Loyola High School here in L.A. Thanks to you both for coming on. We do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve. Really appreciate it.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW. Steve Chiatakis here. Strike averted in OC. Tens of thousands of bus riders were almost out of a ride, but just in the nick of time, drivers, their union reps, and the Orange County Transportation Authority reached a tentative deal, narrowly avoiding a walkout. Nearly 600 drivers who haven't had a contract since April of last year were asking for a, quote, fair contract that would include things like bathroom breaks and an increase in wages. Here to talk more about it is Gustavo Arellano, of course, columnist of the LA Times and a regular here on GLA. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
It took almost a full day, 22 hours of negotiating. They brought in a mediator. There was, you know, this looming threat of a strike, but we do have a deal. What was at the heart of the disagreement between the drivers and the TA?
It was interesting to see, you know, I was surprised, first of all, that they're unionized. This is Orange County, historically very anti-union, and they're organized by the Teamsters. And so what they wanted was just higher wages, especially in a place as expensive to live as Orange. You need money to be able to live here. But more importantly, they were really pushing the bus drivers and the union on this idea of, quote, human dignity. That's literally the quote that they kept saying again and again to the press. And it really boiled down to bathroom breaks.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, the coach drivers wanted a contract that would include those bathroom breaks and then, and you said the raise in wages and lunch breaks and things like that. I don't understand you don't get a bathroom break?
So the way it's set up, that according to the OCTA at least, that they give them 4 15-minute breaks to figure out how to use during the course of their routes. But remember, we're talking about bus drivers here going, driving long distances across Orange County back and forth. At some point, you have to eat. At some point, what we humans do arises. And because of that, though, because they only have four, they have to plan them out in a certain way. And so sometimes it has to happen more often. And so what the Teamsters did, they documented many bus drivers saying, like, because of how limited in time we have, we'd have to wear diapers. We'd have to urinate in bottles. Or sometimes we would just not go. And as a course, because of that, we'd have bladder infections. So it was really remarkable just to see how raw the testimony was. And also, frankly, how honest they were about a subject a lot of people don't want to talk about.
I want to ask you this, because last week we had our reporter, Kaylee Wells, and she talked to us about bus service in L.A., and she found out that there were cuts in service, you know, low pay for drivers. A lot of drivers were just leaving their jobs altogether. I mean, does the OC have a similar issue going on there?
As far as I could tell, no. I mean, the drivers like their work. They just want to get paid well, and they want to have enough of flexibility to be able to have breaks. But again, Orange County is a very expensive place to live. And so that was one of the key factors in, or the key tensions in the contract negotiations, was getting a higher wage. And so obviously the Teamsters were ready to go strike. They were, the union was ready to go strike. All these bus drivers were. And obviously at the 22nd hour, like, as you said, like, they came in and they agreed. And so obviously in negotiations, each side has to give a little to get a little. So obviously the bus drivers are happy enough with what they got so far.
And we do know that the DA, Todd Spitzer, right, pretty conservative Republican, Irvine Mayor Farah Khan, they supported the drivers' efforts in negotiations, right?
Yeah, I was really surprised by Todd, because he usually doesn't throw himself out there on quote-unquote liberal causes. But him and Farah Khan, a Democrat in a liberal city, I understood that. But they both made the point that, look, the people who would be affected by this, it wouldn't be the people down in South OC in the richer part of Orange County. It would be mostly people in Santa Ana, older folks, people of color, immigrants, young people. If there was a bus strike, 75% of the people would be affected, or, you know, on certain lines, and that would be devastating for them. They'd have to try to figure out how to get, you know, particular transportation. It would probably cost them more, say, if they had to get Uber or walk. And both Farah Khan and Todd Spitzer, people don't like Todd, but this is true. They actually do care for folks. And so, of course, they were going to go out and say something about OCTA.
What's been the response from the Transportation Authority or the OCTA?
So far, nothing. But of course, they're probably going to say, well, you know, we're not going to disrupt anything, because that's one of the things that they were saying, that they were threatening to go to Governor Gavin Newsom, who has the authority. Again, things you learn. He had the authority to tell the bus drivers, you cannot go on strike until I convene a board to investigate whatever allegations you may have against OCTA before you could go on strike. So it didn't get to that point, obviously, but it would have been quite something to have Newsom tell union folks, hey, you got to keep working. So go get to it.
Were they negotiating through the period I mentioned at the outset that the, you know, their contract expired last year, almost a year ago? Why did the union and the OCTA let the previous contract lapse then and then not do anything? I mean, were they negotiating in good faith up to this point?
Any contract negotiations got to take a while, back and forth. I'm sure the pandemic compounded just, you know, the usual negotiations of that. And also, frankly, over the past couple of years, as you've seen more pay inequity, as you've seen more stratification, I'm sure that's and inflation, I'm sure that's weighed a lot on these bus drivers. And so they went to OCTA and said, look, we need more than whatever you're offering us. And OCTA says, well, we don't have the budget to do so. And that back and forth went on and on. Yeah, almost a year. But that's not unprecedented. These things happen all the time when it comes to unions and negotiations.
Do we know what's in the tentative agreement, the deal that's on the table right now?
Not just yet.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times, and of course a regular here on GLA. Gustavo, as always, thanks.
Gracias.
That's it for us today. Tomorrow, off to one of the last two trash incinerators in California, in Long Beach, and how it's affecting all the folks who live nearby. Yeah, a lot of fire and smoke. Online always at kcrw.com/GLA. Tell us how you're doing and share your thoughts with us, too. Throw us some ideas, story ideas, that is, at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. And, of course, grab the podcast on the regular, too. Subscribe to it at the website or wherever you get your podcasts. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Tom, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl all put some hard work and elbow grease in this evening's episode. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thanks for the ear and your time tonight. Have a great night.